Hey everyone, it's Justin here. Before we get into our episode on Anatomy of a Fall, I just want to say thanks to Scott for reaching out to us at cowspod@gmail.com. Scott requested Anatomy of a Fall, and I'm really glad that he did because this was a really fun episode to record. So thanks, Scott. And for other listeners out there, please do reach out to us. We always enjoy hearing from people, and it makes us feel like we're not just talking into the void. It's nice to know that somebody's listening and appreciating some of the things we do. So do reach out to us. And if you have requests, always eager to hear them. All right, without further ado, here is our episode on Anatomy of a Fall.
Because this might be the inner chronicle of what we are. And we have to articulate ourselves. Otherwise, we would be cows in the field.
Welcome to Cows in the Field. This is a show in which we discuss philosophical themes in popular films. My name is Justin.
I'm Laura.
And today we're kicking off a series of 2023 movies with Justine Triet's slippery meditation on truth and narrative, Anatomy of a Fall. And welcoming to the show, we have Veronica Fitzpatrick. Veronica is a visiting professor in the Department of Modern Culture and Media at Brown and the co-host of the Bright Wall Dark Room podcast. Welcome to Cows in the Field, Veronica.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, we're talking about the movie Anatomy of a Fall, which came out this year. Well, it came out in 2023. And so I don't want to presuppose at this point that anyone has seen it, but we are going to presuppose that in a second. But before we do so, I just want to go around and maybe give a brief pitch for why people who might be on the fence about whether to see this movie should see it. So, Veronica, do you want to start us off? Like, what would you say, how would you pitch the movie to someone who hasn't seen it?
So I would say that I recommend the film as a really serious fan of procedurals, of television procedurals specifically. I think it's like Broadchurch in the Alps. I think if you think it's like a kind of inaccessible, like multi-language French co-production film that's like a bit long, it's actually like a lot kind of pulpier and more accessible than that. And if you like any sort of kind of crime content and procedural content specifically, courtroom dramas, Law and Order, SVU, everything in that kind of wheelhouse, which I'm all about, then you will enjoy this film.
That's a great way to pitch it. Yeah, Laura, do you have a...
Mine was very similar. I was thinking Broadchurch in the Alps is so good. I was thinking about Broadchurch a lot during this. I think maybe just because the French and British judicial system has more wigs and tall chairs and things that like look very fancy and imposing. But also I was weirdly thinking about the OJ Simpson, Ryan Murphy show.
Oh yeah.
And what
the
connects
people
that?
Versus OJ Simpson.
People versus OJ Simpson. Thank you. And as a person who is a fan of procedurals, a murderino, a Law and Order head, but also somebody who grapples a lot with like how your faves are problematic and, you know, what it really means to be obsessed with these stories and to love like a really easy tie them up with the bow at the end of the episode, Perry Mason episode of the justice system. You know, I know that's there's a lot more going on. And sometimes I struggle with like the voyeurism that I'm enjoying when I listen to a murderino, my favorite murder podcast or something like that. So as somebody who both loves it and also maybe struggles with it, this is a perfect film.
Okay, I like that. Yeah, I mean, the way I was thinking of it is actually from the production side of things rather than the consumer side of things. But I like that too. I mean, I think it's a movie that is much like May December, a movie which I think everyone should also see. But if you have seen May December, I think you'll like Anatomy of a Fall too. These are movies reflecting on the creative process and how much you, by drawing from your own experience in your life, are thereby implicating people in ways potentially against their will and without their consent that is complex and inevitable, because even if you're not making writing a story about something that really happened, you're always borrowing from your own life. And I think this is a movie that's always reflecting kind of on that. And I think that is, it's kind of interesting to me that we had two sort of prominent movies about, I mean, probably even more this year now, if I actually think about it, but it definitely those two have been in my mind as kind of connected. And so I loved May December. So that would be my pitch. It's just kind of, it's like one, it's like the Frenchy, more Frenchy version of May December. I don't. That's not a great pitch.
Broadchurch, May December, People versus O.J. Simpson.
Yeah, there you go. Those are the touchstones.
I mean, it's three winners. I feel like. Yeah.
Okay, so we're now going to basically talk freely about the film. So if you haven't seen it, I'd recommend watching it and then coming back. Although, in some sense, I think we're gonna try. I want to try to get us to spoil this film, almost immediately with my next question. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if it's possible to spoil this film. That's the problem I face. So here's the question I want to ask next. What happened?
Mm.
Okay, so this is a movie in which the main character, Sandra Voiter, played by Sandra Hüller, is accused of murdering her husband because her husband falls out of their chateau, out of the, you know, window out of the chateau and dies. And at least three possibilities are floated in the film. Potentially more. So here's one thing that potentially happened, which is the possibility floated by Sandra herself. He just fell. It was an accident. He just fell out of the window.
Do you want us to say what we think about that?
No. Then there are two other very prominent ones. What is Laura?
There is the possibility that Sandra hit him on the head, shoved him out the window, and murdered him. Mm-hmm. And then there is the possibility that he chose to end his life and threw himself out the window.
Are there any other possibilities? Like, Veronica, does that seem right?
Yeah. I think that those are the main kind of like options that are floated about what happened to Samuel. But I think that, early on when like the hot defense attorney, Vincent, comes to visit Sandra.
So hot.
It has to be said up front. It's a spoiler.
Just laugh because all last night I was like, he's so hot.
He's so good looking. Yeah. So, you know, when he comes to visit her for the first time and we're kind of getting like a whiff that they know each other from before, she interrupts him while he's in preliminary kind of question mode and says, I did not kill him. And he says, that's not the point.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's such a primer for ultimately the film's sort of like attitude toward what happened. It is, I totally agree, like centrally, structurally concerned with what happened. And I think those are absolutely the three kind of options. But what happens in the film is like the trial, the decision, what happens ultimately in the aftermath with her son, who is sort of paradoxically the film's only witness.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. I was thinking about that a lot as I rewatched the film this morning, about that sort of distinction there between like what happened to Samuel and what happens in the film in terms of its plotting.
Now, looking for a stranger who walks in, kills him while you were sleeping right above and Daniel was up for a walk is a shitty strategy. Samuel had no enemies.
Stop. I did not kill him.
That's not the point, really.
To me, the interpretive question, when you start to think of the interpretive question, that is just the basic interpretive question of like what happened in this movie or what happened prior to the main events of the film. The thing that's interesting, there's many things that are interesting, but one thing that's interesting is that you immediately become implicated in the plot of the film the way the characters are. Mm. So we're all in the same boat. We're all trying to solve this thing. And the interpretive mechanisms that are brought to bear by the characters in the film are in some ways similar to the interpretive mechanisms that we, the audience, bring to bear on the question. So for instance, one of the things that I was thinking about the entire time was not like, well, like, what's the evidence here? It was like, what would be the more satisfying answer to the question? Like, what would narratively be more satisfying if, and that's actually weirdly what led me to the conclusion that that was actually quite a mundane coincidence that he just slipped or something. Mm. In part because narratively, I think that helps the film make a really, I think, make several interesting points. One of which is that Sandra then is not lying at all, except when she's trying to get people to believe mm-hmm. the thing that she believes, namely that she's innocent. She has to lie. She has to lie about Samuel's suicide and this and that, because she doesn't believe that. She doesn't believe he committed suicide. But she's told very early on by Vincent, the lawyer, that hot lawyer, excuse me, the silver fox, as Laura was saying throughout, whatever you think is, and that's not really what's at issue here. What's at issue is what will make a good story for the
right.
the legal
system. Because he immediately rules out the accidental fall, as he says it's not believable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But what he means is that it's not very interesting or compelling.
Yeah, it's not compelling.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do think it's interesting that we use that word compelling both in two ways. I was thinking about that actually. Mm-hmm. Like, compelling means we believe it, but also when it's used in the context of a fictional story, it means like gripping or something like that. Because of course, believability doesn't arise when fiction. We know it's fiction. We know we're not going to believe it, but nonetheless, compelling is somehow like keeps your interest, mm-hmm. and we have that. It has that sort of dual use, and this film I think is right at that edge of playing with that dual use of the notion of compelling, either believability or like I would call it like narrative satisfaction or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it totally helps that once we get to the trial. Which is like, I think just a little less than an hour into the film. It's so theatrical. Like, yeah. And I don't know anything, I'll admit, about like the French legal system or the Alpine legal system or whatever, like wherever specifically they are. But I do watch, as it sounds like maybe you do too, a lot of like British crime dramas. So I'm really mm-hmm. overly familiar with like how to read Miranda rights in British and like
yeah.
DCI, yeah. whatever, okay. you know, like the wigs, mm-hmm. as you're saying. But yeah, that whole like proscenium where we have like, you know, this kind of jury overseeing everything and the height difference and the verticality in the room and the fact that Antoine Reinhardt is playing the prosecutor with like way too much flair, and that, you know, that whole huge section of the film seems to place us in the position of being in the courtroom gallery and like laughing along at moments when there are like, you know, little punchlines or stingers that make it almost seem like vaudeville or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the idea that the court, which is simultaneously a legal court and a court of public opinion, is a theater in which we enact the private our private lives, or at least Sandra is forced to enact or tell a story about her own private life, is that I think is totally there. And I think it's one point where I was rewatching some scenes right before this, and one point that one scene I absolutely had to rewatch was the pivotal scene in the courtroom where they're playing the recording mm-hmm. of Sandra and Samuel. Mm-hmm. And the thing that was that I guess it immediately jumped out at me the second time. So we're seeing I guess it's a flashback to mm-hmm. What has happened. We go back to the courtroom yeah. at that pivotal point right before the violence erupts, mm-hmm. right? So that we can be a little bit unclear about that. Mm-hmm. But when we go back to the courtroom, the first image we see is some just random dude in the courtroom. It's just some random guy who we've never seen before sitting in the audience. Mm-hmm. And then we do some faces of other people. Eventually we land on Daniel and it lingers on him while he's hearing his parents, you know, fight. And it's obviously that's an important dimension of this, is the trauma that this is inflicting on Daniel. Mm. But I think what's interesting is the context in which that trauma is being positioned on him, is because he's having to not only hear all that stuff, hear all the dirty stuff his parents would not have wanted him to hear about their relationship, but he also has to do that in public. He has to go through it with all these other strangers.
Yeah.
They like, and how embarrassing that is for him. And you know, and I think like that dimension of the the being forced to sort of like perform and justify your private life is, you know, it's brutal. And then when you think about what the movie itself is, this is why I think the connection to May December is useful. It's metafictionally that thing, because Justine Trier wrote this with her partner. Mm-hmm. And this is a theme from what I've read about some of her films, where this is their films draw on her own life in various ways. And so she is, I think, you know, reflexively commenting on the act of fiction making in a way where it's supposed to be analogous to what Sandra's going through, where it's a kind of performing of elements of your private life, often in ways that are, you know, using the dimensions of people who aren't necessarily agreeing to that kind of performance, but you're using them in it. And she's wondering, as a filmmaker, I think, or exploring at least, the consequences of that. And I think that's where the film, like, these layers sort of collapse in really interesting ways. But yes, this is all just to say the courtroom stuff is awesome. Did you like the court? You like the courtroom stuff, right, Laura?
Yeah, of course. I love a courtroom procedural. It's interesting that you're focusing most on the fiction and in the public versus private piece of that. I was just thinking about how certain, you know, we want to be about these stories of a crime that takes place, and how manufactured or how much interpretation is happening. I was just thinking about the two blood spatter analysts, right, who are both using like various tools to try to add more credibility to their version of the story, which is complete opposite versions of the story. But one has like a dummy and one has a virtual reenactment. Yeah. Right.
Well, and she's also enacting it herself. She's like bending over and
right. So she's bringing that theatricality to it, but they're also bringing these technology or tools that look as if like that's somehow going to create like a, that gives them an objectivity, or, you know, that somehow that they have access to the truth of it through, you know, what we, through science, which is how we've like this injustice system over the years has, you know, first it was like fiber analysis, then it's DNA analysis. And we're always making a story and doing our very best to put together the pieces that we can really never access the full truth. So that was like the parts that gripped me the most during the courtroom scenes.
Veronica, so you mentioned, what was the name? The Antoine Reinhardt.
Yeah, Reinhardt's, I think.
Reinhardt's, yeah. Mm-hmm. I just think of him as, this is probably mean. I thought he's Marshall Mathers, LLM, right? Because he looks like Eminem. But anyway, what did you think of him? I mean, he is incredibly theatrical. And and what he's doing with, where he's trying to put, I mean, there's also a gender dimension, of course, too, but he's trying to trip up Sandra and get her to admit things, and he has these snide little remarks that he makes throughout. So, how are you thinking about him and then, of course, her defense lawyer as well, kind of going at one another?
Yeah, it's like an angel and a devil.
yeah.
I love Reinhardt's performance and the kind of like puckishness of it. When I saw the film for the first time, it was at New York Film Festival, and the audience, I feel like it was one of the screenings that I was in where people had a really coherent, sort of sensible response to things, like a sort of collective response to things. And there was so much collective suspense and delight when the prosecution was sort of like laying out his case. But I think that his manipulation of the story for, you know, the benefit of prosecution, he's just the figurehead for like a whole position, it seems to me. And the gender dynamic is probably what interests me most in the film, the sort of like reading of her and depiction of her, Sandra, the writer, as this ultra confident, unshakable, kind of super ambitious, super focused professional, as opposed to maybe a spouse and a mother. I'll admit it's completely fascinating to me to be talking to an actual married couple about the film because, and not just a married couple, but also like people who like went to school and write, you know, because like to be in the audience at Lincoln Center when she says, don't worry about me, I always manage to write, was like a harrowing experience.
Yeah, I bet.
You know, you could feel this like bristle or something. I'm most interested in that aspect of the fight probably and in the film and that aspect of the film in general. But I mean, there does seem to me this like interesting, like deep tension between representation, including the kind of like reenactments that we have that you were describing, like the physical reenactments, but also things like Vincent sketching at the beginning of the film. And I love how there's this like visual tension between his shitty stick figures and the like ostensible certainty of graph paper that he's like sketching on. And so reenactments and recording and reality, you know, like Sandra says, that recording is not reality. But then when the film cuts seamlessly from the recording being played in the courtroom to the flashback, it sort of makes me question, like, well, isn't it? Or isn't it some kind of like reliable portal to at least one version of what reality was?
Yeah, I like that idea of the disconnect between representation and reality, which is another thing you were getting at, Laura, as well. And you're right that the film lulls us into thinking that we have a kind of access via the recording when we do that flashback, because we get the flashback. And so we didn't get the visual. We get to see things that are on the recording. We get to see her facial expressions, and her face acting, especially in that scene, is amazing. She does a couple things, Sandra Hüller, where it's like the quick glance over at Samuel when he's saying certain lines and the confidence on her face. These are things which would not be privy to the court because they're only hearing the recording. But then the film kind of pulls the rug out from under us because it cuts back at that pivotal moment when
right before the
fighting and whatever.
Yeah.
And we don't know what is going on then in those moments, because all we can hear are thuds and hits and smacks and breaking. And then we're immediately like at sea again, and we're back to, okay, we just have to trust Sandra when she recounts what happened. But then, you know, so it's that, I like that idea of it. Like, it's like Trier is trying to lull us into thinking that we have a better epistemic grasp of what's going on, and then removes it to sort of show that actually we don't, because, you know, yeah, these are fictional characters, but like we weren't there. All we have is mediated access to whatever happened. There's another interpretation of that quote unquote flashback where it's not, it's just her in her mind imagining what's happening. And that isn't actually reflective of what really happened. So the visuals that we're getting there, I mean, we interpret it, I think the default is to interpret it as genuine, but it's not a guarantee. And so I think then Trey is like kind of like allowing us to like have that degree of uncertainty, and then what we're left with to interpret is her face, Sandra's face, and that's the thing that I believe her, and the performance is, I think, kind of incredible. And part of it is that, like, apparently this is just IMDb trivia, so I don't know, but apparently Justine Trier told her to play it like she's innocent.
I heard opposite.
Oh, wait, what?
I had read that she asked again and again, did my character do it? And Justine's like, I'm not saying.
No. Okay, but I think
but
no,
to play
I think
it like
she might have said that, but then also said play it like your character believes she's innocent.
Okay.
And those are compatible, but I do think she really, I believe her. I think there's something like mystical about that performance where I believe her, but I'm also like, it seems like kind of improbable, like her side of her story, which we don't get much of, but I believe her. And I think a lot of that is the confidence that she exudes. And this is speaking to what you're saying, Veronica, about like the other dimension is this gender division of labor stuff, which comes up. And of course the husband feels to some degree, you know, overshadowed by his more successful spouse who has no problem writing, even, I mean, by her own account, even when he's blasting the Snoop Dogg mm-hmm. track, she can write. She's like, I can work 50 cents. She's like, I can write in any circumstance. And I have to say, kudos to her, because I cannot write in any circumstance. No.
So it's more of like a Shining situation in this house.
Yes.
Doesn't always last, but he's like, you know, we always recount that scene. When you hear me typing, whatever you hear it here, I'm working. I'm just kidding. Justin's lovely. And everything's fine.
It's fine. Our relationship is totally fine for the listeners.
Totally fine.
It's totally good. I'm not jealous of your novels.
Yeah, no, that's definitely the key. We're not two academics. I'm not writing anything.
But I do love, I mean, that scene is a real keystone scene. Yes. I think that, and it's, I don't know.
I know. What does she say? A relationship is a kind of chaos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's what, there's a sort of absurdity in trying to find truth in, as if it's like an objective fact inside of a relationship, which is moving and chaotic and ebbing and flowing. And I believe that Samuel at one point said, okay, you can take my idea. Yeah, I'm not using it. And then like also felt totally betrayed by the fact mm-hmm. that she did use it mm-hmm. so successfully.
Yep.
And then later considers it a plunder. I believe that her version of it and his version of it are true. Because, you know, he feels a different way about it. And like this, you know, in order to get closure, we're in this trial trying to find, to pin something down that cannot be pinned down.
Well, it's in part because, and this is why I think the private public thing is important. This is in some ways only interpretable, and even maybe not even to them, but only interpretable to the parties involved. You know what's going mm-hmm. on? It's so complicated. There's such
and I don't even think history, to them.
I know that's what I mean. It's like but they're in the best position to understand it because. Understand what's going on because they've had this rich history of a life together. And that's what's so interesting is to then have that turned inside out and have a bunch of people from the outside who haven't gone through that sort of now be in the position to not just be able to interpret it, but be asked or forced to interpret it, right? To be able to be like, now I'm going to tell you what I think about this, where I'm not a part of this relationship, I have no idea. You know, the other movie that meant that this kind of comes up very briefly is Oppenheimer. Mm-hmm. He, you know, the kitty and Robert Oppenheimer, he's like, we've been, you know, we're grownups. We've been through, I don't know what he says, we've been through hell together. I can't remember. But he talks about like, we've had this rich relationship. He's trying to assure Krumholtz's character that Kitty will be fine on the stand. And I think like that is, it is, you know, it's something that I think, it's true. I mean, you know, the complexities that of the interpersonal dynamics between two people who've been together for a long time. Wow. How long have we been together, Laura? 15 years, something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. Like you develop this weird shorthand with each other and there's like kind of trust there that's like hard to explicate, you know?
Yeah.
And doesn't really make sense to the outside.
Right. And the public is trying to interpret it to on some sexist grounds and also some normative grounds, like they're sort of perplexed by she's constantly having to like to sort of justify that her relationship was a real and loving one because it didn't look the way that mm-hmm. you might expect like a heteronormative man-woman marriage to look, not just in terms of like who was the moneymaker, who was more successful, but like they don't share a bed, but they have these like the way she describes that they get up at 6 before Daniel's awake and just have this moment every morning. Like that's so beautiful. Yeah. But like, some people are like, well, that's not how it should look. You know, it should be like, I don't know. I love Lucy or in only one bed instead of two, but you know, the fact that like, yes, she's had her affairs and he knew about it and like, no, that they're not 100% happy about it, but it's like,
they're
it's
working
a fact
through
it. Of
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
You know, that's something that's like so hard for anybody to understand from the outside.
Yeah.
Except two people who have like been in it for 15 years.
And the whole movie is, it feels like it's Sandra trying to explain this kind of stuff to mm-hmm. a third party, either the lawyer, the courtroom, you know, the prosecutor, her son. I mean, and that's like, that's what's kind of the magic of it, is it's like, how do you, it's like they capture something about the complexity of being forced to do that. And again, I think what's also doubly interesting is that that is the process of a writer. It's like trying to make explicit these feelings or thoughts of a character in ways that make sense to some outside party. And I think the way we do that, and this is where I think for me it comes back to narrative, is we usually embed these actions or events and things in some kind of narrative structure. And that is the way we make sense of them from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole movie is this like attempt to take these disparate elements and embed them in various narrative structures that are themselves incompatible. And like, who wins is the one that's like most compelling in some way.
Right.
I'm not the one that's necessarily true, because if my interpretation is right, it's not the one that's true.
Right.
I mean, he wasn't suicidal, but that's the sort of story that wins the day.
And the person who's sort of looking after Daniel, the court appointed, I don't even know, chaperone.
babysitter.
Right. Like, yeah. She sort of advises him to like, to pick a narrative. Right. Because he's like, I can't even understand my own memories. I don't know how to parse this. I don't know what to do. And she's like, sometimes we just have to decide. He's like, you just want me to like believe one way or the other. She's like, no, just decide. Pick a narrative, you know?
Yeah.
And then just fill in what you need and then move on.
I think that's right. I mean, I think, and in some ways, that experience that Daniel is being forced to do is the experience of that we sort of all come to eventually in our life as we mature, where we're forced to, as you get older and older, you become forced to do this more and more, where you're forced to sort of pass judgment on something. And, you know, I think there's a certain risk that one takes, and it is a kind of thing where we're always doing this. Like, there are very few things that are certain. So we're always sort of in believing one way or the other, passing a certain degree of judgment. And that risk is, I think, tough, because if he, in his case, if he chooses wrongly, I mean, the stakes are sort of existential. I mean, right? Like, he wants to believe his mom is innocent so that he can have one parent out of this whole situation, but he's now learned all this weird stuff about his mom, stuff he did not want to have to deal with as a, what, 10-year-old or however old he is.
Yeah.
And then I think that's the real tragedy of the film is the ending, where she's ultimately acquitted, but when she goes home sort of happily to him, well, first of all, she has to ask. I mean, I think that is already heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, can I come home? And like, that already is like a moment of just, that's like gut wrenching. But then she goes home and she can't really even be with him. She ends up having to go and sleeps in Samuel's office, right?
Yeah.
Is that where she goes?
Office.
Yeah.
And
she sleeps.
But she's
with
also kind of like, she comes home and then she has this really long dinner. Like, she's
no, she
scared,
has their dinner. It's
she's
true.
She's scared to come home, and he's scared to have her come home,
yeah,
is what they say. But mm-hmm. she's sort of like putting it off, because she's like, she doesn't know what that life is going to look like with him after.
Yeah. It's.
Oh. But she gets some really good doggo snuggles.
On lighter note, the dog's name is Snoop, which I think is interesting, that the it's about sort of prying and snooping, and not Snoop Dogg, although Snoop Dogg is a great, that would be good too, but yeah, that it is like this kind of, you know, that the process of producing fiction is in a way lending a kind of external lens into your own private life and the kind of complexity that induces. But Veronica, so you write, do you think that to some extent or to any extent the role of the critic or the the theorist, when you write, you are of course revealing aspects of yourself, and mm-hmm. do you feel like there is, do you feel any compunction about that in the way that, the potentially Trier feels about like the fiction author does, you know, that they're kind of like laying bare aspects of themselves in their work?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, in terms of my own like prose it's, I think, sort of explicitly not personal. It's pretty unusual for me even to use like the first person in like a sort of essay. But it's there's kind of like a decoder ring aspect where if you know me, if you're a friend of mine, if you like know what I've been thinking about or my recent experiences or my process, you would see quite a bit. And yeah, I feel totally nervous about that sometimes and usually won't write about things that are super immediate for like years. Yeah, for precisely that reason. But I think it's all sort of fair game is what I would say. And I don't think that that's like, I mean, I know that it gets raised in the course of the trial as to whether it is or not. And this question of like, did she steal this idea? Did he relinquish the idea? Like what actually happened? But I don't think, I just don't feel totally convinced that the film is that interested in that as a question. It feels a lot more interested to me in this issue of time and like how much time we owe others or are owed by others. I thought it was really interesting that Sandra tells the interviewer at the beginning when she's kind of tipsy at like 1:45 p.m., time is not a problem here. But then time seems to be the chief problem throughout the film. It's the thing that she and Samuel argue about most explicitly. Him sort of saying like, I'm owed this amount of time and her laughing about that. And I mean, Justin, when you were saying like she finds herself in this position as the defendant, certainly, but as the protagonist of the film also, like of explaining herself to others and by extension to the audience, it seems like she's explaining herself, at least in the course of that film or in the course of that fight, to her partner and like contending with the sort of base premise that he has that the relationship should aspire toward a kind of reciprocity. I love the thing that she says. What is it? I don't believe in the notion of reciprocity for a couple. It's naive and frankly, it's depressing. Yeah. I find that to be like the sort of golden truth in the center of the, that's the truth in the film to me. This kind of like just derision that she treats the idea of reciprocity with, which I don't think is like an indictment of collaboration or of mutually agreed upon like principles, but is more like a pointed attack on this really male idea of what reciprocity is, which is not in fact reciprocity, but is like, you should sit down now.
Well, it's definitely a legalistic notion of reciprocity that she's rejecting in the course of a relationship. And I think she's right in that regard. Like relationships are built on a kind of mutual trust and you know, love and friendship. And these are things where it's just inappropriate to be raising questions of, you know, like quid pro quo type questions.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's just, it's just strange. It's like, it's, imagine like, you know, being like, Laura, can you watch Ethan today? And I'll pay you $20 for that.
You guys do know that there is a system up for this. And it's called Fair Play.
It's Fair Play, tell them.
It's a system in which you try to itemize every single domestic task, domestic labor that you and your couple have to do in the household. And then you make cards and you literally know how many cards are in your deck and then you can exchange the cards and then you move the cards.
Yeah. And to Sandra's point, this sounds like a relationship that's on the, if your relationship is using this thing, it sounds like a relationship which is on the edge of collapse.
Well, yeah. I mean, what's interesting about the Fair Play one, which is it, the role reversals that's happening in this movie is that like the perspective of Fair Play is written by a woman for women whom they feel that like the labor they're doing is relatively invisible or flexible.
It's, yes.
And so, right.
The way
and
of so clawing they're like, back.
I have to itemize it and show you that I have 80 cards and you have 20.
I agree. Okay.
And then like, from a male perspective, like perhaps like from a stereotypical male perspective, maybe if like you assume that the man is going to work and crunching numbers, that might be compelling to him to bring the compelling word back.
No, I agree.
But yes, but I think there is, I mean, it is a little like if you're in that moment where you're kind of bartering and you're arguing and you're snipping over this moment, like, you know, this task or how many hours, like, yes, that is.
Yeah. I agree with, let me not be the male chauvinist on this podcast and agree with you that yes, in a situation where, patriarchal social norms has made it such that women's labor is invisible and the only way to like make that visible is to have a punch card system. Yes, that's
right. Fine. But what Samuel's trying to argue is that he's been taking on these tasks that she does not consider to be substantive or time consuming because she's not doing them.
Maybe, yes.
And so she's just cram in your writing. What have you been a big baby for? And he's like, well, I do all these other things that are more, you know, invisible and perhaps gendered feminine in the like old sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I guess what I was just suggesting, and I just don't, I agree with that. And I think what I was suggesting is that like the kind of quid pro quo version of that is one which is, to Sandra's point, which maybe I don't want to fully agree with now, is a kind of, that's a relationship marked where you have mistrust at the center of
yes.
it, where it's like, okay, well, it's a barter system that we have rather than a relationship built on trust. But
you sit down now, he's like, I've logged everything I've done resenting you for 5 years. And now like, it's my time, you know, like that's obviously not a very productive way.
Yeah. But to Samuel's point, the what he's asking for might not necessarily be quote unquote reciprocity, although he puts it that way. What he's asking for is for her to spend more time thinking about their relationship, you know, in a productive way, because he feels like she's checked out of that that relationship, at least in some regards.
He also wants his unicorn space in the system of fair play.
What is that? Is this something? Did I miss?
You guys all need to read Fair Play. And Fair Play, this is good. You want time to yourself again. That's the idea. Some creative task, something like some creative, like something you do that is just for you and not for your family. And she calls that your unicorn space. Okay. He wants his unicorn space.
I mean, Veronica, what do you think? Is he making a, what do you think of this disagreement? Sorry.
I mean, I think it's really persuasive when she's like, I moved to your shitty hometown. I think it's, you know, the problem with the fight is that from Samuel's perspective, only the things that are grievances to him count. And he can't even like admit awareness of these other sacrifices that she's made. The language, conversation is fascinating too.
Yeah.
You know, when he's like, you don't even speak my language. And she's like, we're not speaking mine either. That's what English is for, which is kind of like that Mad Men, like that's what the money is for kind of moment. Mm. It's probably just gasoline for the fight at that point, as opposed to like a useful kind of middle ground. But, you know, I think to me, listening to this fight, I just hear, exactly what she describes, which is this kind of resentment of her success and this avoidance, this kind of self-sabotaging avoidance of his work because he is, what does she say? He's petrified by standards and fear of failure. And I'm like, well, who isn't? Who isn't 40 and petrified by their standards and fear of failure? That's very relatable to me, but, there's no compassion. There's no space for compassion in their fight. That being said, the conversations I had with people after I first saw the film tended to be unanimous that they could see both sides. For me, it's hard to see Samuel's side.
Mm.
I think it's
that's where I was too. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Well, I was going to say that as a potential criticism. I do feel like it's partly because Sandra Hüller is really fucking good,
but she's
she has the better points in that disagreement, I think. But anyway, I do think the movie might have benefited from it being a little bit more even between the two of them.
Mm.
Anyway, but Laura, maybe you're making the case for Samuel, in which case I'm open to being pushed.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, but that's one argument that they've, you know, out of an entire relationship, to her point. And, you know, I think, you know, she probably wasn't super fun to have as a partner.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so maybe he's being a little catty, and maybe he's playing the victim, and maybe he's not being his best self in that argument. But yeah. I'm here for Samuel.
Here's the pitch I can make for Samuel. Like, again, it's that he's, the things he's saying, it's, that's not what it's really about. And when you're cornered and depressed and felt to be belittled by your partner, which obviously Sandra can do that. She's super confident and she's dismissive, and you might be unable to articulate what's really going on, you know, in those moments. And I suspect that what's really going on is that the compassion between them is lost. And she has just very little sympathy for him and what he's going through. And now that could be because he's been moping around for a long time. But, you know, dude's been dealing with depression. It seems clearly he's been going to a therapist. He's been taking medication. And there's a trigger for it, his guilt about what happened with Daniel, which is that he wanted to work on his writing. He sent Daniel with the caregiver or whatever, and then Daniel was hit, and that's what caused his blindness. So I do think he's kind of just asking her for sympathy and compassion. And she does seem, as many successful people are, like somewhat unable to give that to him. Or unwilling, and that is frustrating. And I can see that being so. That would be maybe the pitch for Samuel, is that it's not really what he's saying; it's what's between the lines that he's asking for, and that is an important part of a relationship too. Compassion, like, it does feel like that's missing in those, right? There's no, she has basically no sympathy for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In that disagreement.
You see her compassion for him later, after he dies, when she wants to sort of protect him. She doesn't want to drag him through the mud. She's really resistant to telling about certain parts of their story. And it's Vincent who's like, you got to like pull this stuff out. You got to highlight this. You got to tell it this way. Because she's like, do we have to? Like, he's gone. Why do this to him?
Because I think she truly does not believe that he committed suicide.
No.
And so.
No, but I think she's just like, this is a public record, and this is the way he's going to be remembered. This is how Daniel's going to be, how is he going to remember him? And I don't want him, us all remembering that like one time he puked and maybe he, you know, he tried to make himself sick. I don't know. I don't want to talk about that if I don't have to.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey guys, have you ever gone to the movies and the best part of the show was the trailers? I mean, this has definitely happened to me. I've been to movies before and seen a real stinker and left the theater thinking, well, at least I saw the trailer for blah. I think this happened to me actually when I saw the trailer for the first trailer for The Matrix in, would have been, I guess, early 99 or something. I mean, that trailer ruled. Now, if you're anything like me, you probably have opinions, strong opinions about trailers. So why not put those opinions to work actually making your own trailers? And you can do that. So there's a company called The Refinery. It's one of those companies that actually cuts trailers for some of the major motion picture studios, the picture studios. And they actually have an online training program that teaches you how to edit movie trailers. The program is called The Art of the Trailer, and you can find it at maketrailers.com. And for a limited time, if you use promo code COWS, COWS, at checkout, you'll get 20% off. So go to maketrailers.com, enter promo code COWS at checkout, and get 20% off. Start making trailers today.
There's also those like old photos that we see throughout the title sequence. And then again, we see her kind of like fingering through them at the end. And I'm just curious what you make of those. Like, I mean, beyond so when I saw this, I saw it right about the same time I saw All of Us Strangers, which also has this kind of like old photo fixation and old photographs as a kind of like totem of what really happened or something, like some kind of important kind of artifact that might have an indexical property of some kind. But in this film, because so much of it is about like evidence and like conjurings of possible narratives in lieu of forensic evidence, are they, you know, are they participating in that? Are they more strictly sentimental? Did you think about them at all?
I did think a little bit about it. And now that I'm remembering it, one of the things that sort of struck me by a lot of those photos is that in a bunch of them, they're smiling.
Mm.
And they're kind of out of focus in a lot of them. There are a couple of them where they're sort of together, you know, in kind of candid. So there are very few posed photos. They're mostly candid photos. And that led me to think of two things. One is sort of two very simple things. I'm sure we can go deeper than this, but just one is that like there's this rich history that these two people have. And then the second is that they're blurry. Like they're fading. That history is fading. It's like when you have that memory that you can't quite get before your mind, you know? And we often go to the photos as totems to kind of hold on to the past when it's going away. But the photos themselves are kind of fading away. So I don't know where to make of that. But anyway.
I think you said something similar. I was just thinking about it as like, when I look back at photos of like when you and I met, you know, I'm like, oh, look at those babies. And also like, I sort of don't even quite recognize that Laura from 2009 in some ways. And you know, there are things, important things I think that stay the same, but like you and your partner and the relationship changes infinite amount of times. And you get this sort of weird alienation, I think, sometimes looking back at those old photos.
You asked the question, but I imagine you have some thoughts on this, Veronica. I mean, what were you?
No, I try never to ask questions if I have an answer in mind.
That's good. I wish I could do that, actually. That's
a
superpower.
Yeah, you do a lot of leading questions.
All I have are leading questions.
Yeah.
You're a good professor. So I'm the kind of professor who just like, I just have my own perspective and I'm just like, here you go. Do you think, here's a question for you. I mean, do you find yourself trying to, you know, rekindle the memories via photographs and that kind of thing? Like, did that ring true or is that sort of kind of like alien?
No, not at all. I mean, I think in terms of the film, like, you know, we're talking about how there's so little sort of compassion or even like good faith or softness in Sandra toward Samuel. And I think the photographs as kind of, you know, they sort of testify to this other dimension of their relationship that was comprised of that predominantly and that like kept them together for so long and that ultimately steered her away from Vincent, like who seems like, you know, they seem like they have a good thing going on. But obviously what she had with Samuel was, you know, a lot more significant, at least at that time, which I think is really interesting too. You know, I think it's also like, it's so different now with digital photos and like stuff on your phone versus like analog printed photographs like that. Mostly I feel like my phone's always trying to like show me a memory that I really would prefer to suppress. And it's different when there's like actual concrete film that you're looking at and you've kept in like a box even for a reason.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think a box of film photos is somehow a lot more dear than like a folder on my phone that's going to like emerge.
Who knows?
Without my consent.
Do you remember this? And then they'll like put a strange music to it. And
Just
cinema effect. I'm
right.
Like, oh no.
I have to go back to bed. So, okay. Yeah.
There's something about in the digital case, and I think this is like, you know, in general, just a generality about this, but I do think like in the digital case, it's like it allows us to have so many of something, and then it just as a result, it just cheapens it. I also think it's partly that, and I think it's also like in the digital case, like we don't really know what digital photos are. Like, what if I asked you, like, what is a digital photo? You'd be like, I don't know. It's like some bits of information mm-hmm. that's encoded in a piece of silicon or something. Like, this is really weird. But like, but with a physical photo, there you feel like it's something that, you know, at least with our primitive, like, you know, sapient brains, we can understand, like, this is something, I'm holding it, I'm touching it, and so on. I was just thinking about the, in, with regard to the physical photo, we watched, instead of watching another Justine Triet film last night to prepare for this, we watched The Unknown Country, which is the other Lily Gladstone movie from last year. Mm-hmm. And that's a movie where the main character is basically, I don't know if you've seen it.
I haven't seen it, but I watched the trailer. I remember.
Yeah. She's sort of like got this photograph of her grandmother and she's sort of going on this little road trip ultimately to, like, you know, kind of, you know, on retrace her grandma's steps in some ways. And that she keeps coming back to this physical photograph. And I was really thinking a lot about that as something where I take a lot of photographs. They're all digital. I do print some. But even printing the photograph, I don't feel like I have any photographs that have that feel as special as that character, that photograph felt to that character. You know, something where you like you could literally like go on a journey to discover something about this photograph. And it feels just with digital, there's just nothing equivalent to that. And I do think it's interesting that a lot of the photographs in the film at the top are, they look like they're analog. I mean, many of them. So I don't know. It is the film was shot on digital though, unfortunately. So, you know, whatever. It's fine.
Still looks pretty good.
Yeah, well, it also integrates actually because they have that those I don't know, the camcorder footage that they use with when they're doing recreations with Daniel and so on. And you know, so it cuts that together kind of nice. You know, that's easier to go together and. Again, it's another layer in a way of distance that we have because there we're watching very easily. We could have just been watching, you know, it could have been filmed normally, but then it introduces that layer of like as if we're watching another screen because we're watching the footage that was filmed in the fiction of the world of the movie, and we're watching that being played back. So there has to be some medium in which it's being played back from us. So there's this additional like kind of dimension of remove. And I think, yeah, this, that I just keep coming back to that idea in this film. And I think this kind of idea is something that's been sort of done to death. The idea of like, oh, well, you know, there's a lot of narratives out there. They're all kind of on the par and, oh, look, the media, you know, it's just sort of what and representation in general, it's so easy. Everybody has their own way of sort of telling their side of the story via photograph or the news or whatever. And so mass media has led to this, like, everything, there's no truth anymore because there's all just a bunch of stories. And in a way, this film, I feel like, was within that sort of genre, subgenre of film, like playing in that space, but in a way that I thought was like a little bit more interesting because it was less heavy-handed about some of those ideas. Mm-hmm. And anyway, that to me is something I really enjoyed about it.
And we see so much too of Sandra and Daniel watching the news interpretation of events. So they're there all day and then they're watching the news or the talk shows and that's how we find out the verdict as well, through the television, through Daniel watching the television, not from being in the room.
I guess for just like closing remarks, I mean, like, did you guys ultimately enjoy the film? I mean, is it a film you would want to revisit and, you know, continue to think about?
Yeah, it was really fun revisiting it for this pod, and really interesting because, like, the first time I watched it, I think it's really absorbing in terms of like the momentum and the suspense, and to watch it knowing everything that will happen from a plot perspective, but just sort of like letting my attention wander a little bit more expansively. That was also fun. I mean, I think the only other Trier film I've seen is Sybil, but I really enjoyed that, and I think Justine Triet has a really terrific sense of humor. So I would also say, like, I just think Anatomy of a Fall is a really funny movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's interested, yes, in these kind of themes of, like, what writing entails and, like, what the relationship between writing and experience, whether yours or someone else's really is, but there's a real levity and like kind of like affective range with both of those films that I think we have to mention too.
Thank you for bringing that up, because I actually think that's another connection to May December, which is a hilarious film.
So funny.
And some of the humor is coming from the juxtaposition between the, like, frankly, you know, difficult subject matter, yeah, and then the reactions, plus there's the camera stuff. So there's these zooms in May December, but there's a zoom in this film that's hilarious. It was right after the they play the recording,
yeah,
and then they zoom in on the judge yeah lady, and she goes,
she's bon. So good.
It's a great movie. It's just hilarious.
You have no pity.
Yes, and you have way too much for yourself.
I can't stand any more of your fucking eyes! You're violent!
Yes, I am violent!
Bon, vous pouvez nous expliquer où a été retrouvé cet enregistrement?
That's just that really dry sort of humor, yeah, that I think, and you know, Todd Haynes is just a master of that. I mean, the tone that he's charting with May December is just like, you know, God level in terms of like making you simultaneously feel uncomfortable and want to laugh and also wonder whether you should be laughing. It's like, it's brilliant. And in this, that was just like a total laugh out loud moment. I loved that.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw an interview where they were talking about the 50 Cent song and how they were originally wanted Jolene and then they couldn't get the rights. And then like, what brought you to 50 Cent? And she's just like, it's funny.
Yeah.
Like, it is like, it's a funny choice and also horrifying. Like it's such that's such a gallows humor. Like this is the song that he dies to and his family finds him bloody in the snow too.
It's just blasting for, you know, 5 minutes of the movie or whatever.
Yep.
Well, Veronica, thank you very much for joining us. And the Brightwell Darkroom podcast, which you co-host with Chad, is great. And people should listen to
you.
It. It's really nice. And I think like, and people can read you on, you've written for Brightwell Darkroom. Mm-hmm. Where else could people find your writing or find you on social media?
On social media. So on, I guess, Twitter, I'm at Gudo Mako. And my personal website is linkable from there. It's a Tumblr page, probably will be for the rest of my life.
Okay. And your writing is on, you have writing on Brightwell Darkroom.
Brightwelldarkroom.com, Screen Slate.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks for coming. And we are at CowsPod on Twitter. You can find us on the web at CowsPod.com. In 2 weeks, we'll be talking to someone who's been on Brightwell Darkroom podcast a bunch, Fran Hoffner.
My dear buddy.
About The Iron Claw. So another 23 movie, which we have to go see. So we have to go see it like this weekend, actually.
Okay.
We have to figure out a babysitter because I was kind of hoping it would come streaming so I wouldn't have to actually do the babysitter thing, but I think it is not going to be streaming
in
time.
We'll do it for Fran.
Yeah. So so tune in 2 weeks for that. All right. Bye.
I don't know what you heard about me. But a bitch can't get a dollar out of me. No Cadillac, no perms, you can't see. Then I'm a motherfucking B.I.M.B. I don't know what you heard about me. But a bitch can't get a dollar out of me. No Cadillac, no perms, you can't see. Then I'm a motherfucking P.I.M.B. Now shawty, she in the club, she dancing for dollars. She got a thing for that Gucci, that Fendi, that Prada. That BCBG, Burberry, Dolce and Cabana. She feed them fools fantasies, they pay her cause they want her. I
spit a little G-Man in my gang, got a hour later, had her ass up in the Ramada. Them trick niggas in the ear saying they think about her. I got the bitch by the bar trying to get a drink about her. She like my style, she like my smile, she like the way I talk. She from the country, then she like me cause I'm from New York. I ain't that nigga trying to holler cause I want some head. I'm that nigga trying to holler cause I want some bread. I could care less how she perform when she in the bed. Bitch at that track, catch a date and come and pay the kid. Look baby, this is simple, you can't see. You fucking with me, you fucking with a P-I-M-P.
I don't know what you heard about me. But a bitch can't get a dollar out of me. No Cadillac, no perms, you can't see. Then I'm a motherfucking P.I.M.P. I don't know what you heard about me. But a bitch can't get a dollar out of me.